Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how it all affects our nation's future. This week, we'll hear from Zach Moeller, director of the economic program at Third Way, a center-left think tank in Washington. Zach recently co-authored an issue brief titled A Democratic Case for Fiscal Responsibility. And he will make that case with us today. Concord Coalition Policy Director Tory Gorman and Chief Economist Steve Robinson join the conversation. And then in our final segment, Tory, Steve, and I will take a look at the latest inflation numbers released last week by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and how they might affect the Federal Reserve Board's decision on interest rates at its upcoming meeting. Well, Zach Moeller's bio says that he loves a well-researched white paper and thoughtful economic policy, which is something we certainly appreciate around here. As director of Third Way's economic program, Zach oversees a team that specializes in developing innovative policies on topics like paid leave, housing, apprenticeships, and retirement. He's also Third Way's resident federal budget and appropriations nerd. His word, not mine. but I can confirm it. His work has been featured prominently in the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, NPR, and now Facing the Future. And I should mention that before Third Way, Zach had some experience on Capitol Hill at the Budget Committee. And he also was a senior policy advisor at the policy analyst at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. So very well credentialed. And Zach, welcome to Facing the Future.
Bob, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, let's get right to the issue report that you did. You know, your report lays out five reasons why Democrats must not only pay for policies, but also slow the projected growth of the national debt. The first one of those, well, let me just read through the first, all five, and then we'll take them one at a time.
Sure.
Just so people know where we're going. First one is we're burning money rather than investing in our causes. The second one is the current budget neglects kids in favor of seniors. The third one is we're lying to ourselves about the Social Security challenge. Number four is revenue is leaking everywhere. And number five, Republicans attack progressive spending like a rabid dog. That again is your words, not mine. Just for our nonpartisan audience. Okay, so, but this is a Democratic case for fiscal responsibility. So let's take the first one first. We're burning money rather than investing in our causes. Explain what you mean on that one.
Sure, absolutely. And Bob, before I kind of dig into that, you know, for full disclosure to your audience, I'm a Democrat. I've worked for Democrats. And I am trying to speak, you know, this issue brief is speaking to fellow Democrats about why we need to focus on fiscal issues more so than we have in recent years. The numbers don't lie. We've reached a point where making progress on Democratic priorities isn't possible without kind of a newfound commitment to fiscal responsibility. So that is kind of the point of view I brought to this piece. Now, talking about interest spending. You know, why I'm talking about we're burning this money, because we're just spending a lot more servicing the national debt than we have in a long time. There's a chart that Paul Krugman used to point to a lot in, 10, 15 years ago about why we didn't need to care about the national debt. And it's what we're spending on interest payments compared to a share of the economy. And 15 years ago, 10 years ago, it was very low and historically low. But that has dramatically changed. And we are projected to have net interest costs as a share of the economy growing very rapidly because we have high interest rates today, because we have a higher stock of national debt, and you know, because the economy is going to continue to grow, but not grow at a super fast clip like we saw in the 90s. So there is a big challenge here, and the money we're spending on interest is not things that Democrats want to be spending money on, like children or Medicare or making sure that Social Security is solvent. And we'll get into Social Security later. But to me, for Democrats, Democrats should care because it's all about priorities. Spending more on interest is less money to spend on kids, national parks, food inspectors, and more.
So it to you, it has a crowding out effect. Is that the what you're worried about? I don't mean crowding out in the economic sense. I mean crowding out in the budgetary sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, yes, obviously there's some crowding out in the economic sense, but it is crowding out in the budgetary sense. Whether or not you think it should be, I think there's a lot of you know, folks on the broader left who are like, well, we should just be spending more on kids, regardless of what we're spending on interest. But there is an inherent political tension when interest spending is that high that, you know, okay, if interest spending was a little bit lower, maybe the political wheels would be greased a little bit more for another priority. But when interest spending is high, it creates this challenge functionally, even if it's not, you know, doesn't have to be.
And it's about 11% of the budget now, interest?
So yeah, it's about 11% and growing. Last year, we spent about $660 billion on interest spending. That's going to be a lot more this year because our existing national debt stock rolls over at higher interest rates when interest rates are higher like they are now. And so it's projected, it is the fastest growing category of spending. And unless interest rates come down, unless we kind of change the path of the path of debt, you know, it's going to be more and more of a problem.
And it's, I think, next year going to reach record high as a percentage of GDP, somewhere around 3%, 3.2% or something like that. Anyway, let me turn to Tory now for the second proposition in your issue brief.
Zach, thanks for joining us today. And the second point that you make is that we are not investing in our children enough. That we're focused. Our budget is more based on support for senior citizens than it is for children. And I have to say, I read that and literally stood up in my chair and went, hurrah, because this is something that I had been nagging about since I started on the Hill in the late 90s. And you know, from where I sit, if we invested more in children, we would have to invest less in them as senior citizens. And then we would have more money for all these other things that we'd like to do, like build roads and bridges, et cetera, and good schools. So let's talk a little bit about what you mean in terms of we need to invest more in children. First of all, what is sort of the definition of child and programs for children when it comes to federal spending? And can you give me some examples of programs that support children?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, shout out to the Urban Institute and the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, who have done a lot of work looking at this children versus senior spending category. My work in this space kind of builds off of theirs. In terms of what are we talking about when we're talking about spending on children, the biggest, you know, kind of pieces of this are refundable tax credits, like the child tax credit, healthcare spending, like SCHIP, which is healthcare for low-income children or children who have low-income parents, excuse me. Nutrition assistance, like SNAP, food stamps, and then, you know, Title I education spending in the Department of Education, which tends to go to lower income schools. Those are kind of the big categories. And all in all, you know, we're spending about this year, and we'll spend about $1 on a child for every $4 we spend on an elderly person.
Is that just federal spending, or does that also include state and local money that's spent on children programs?
Tori, that's a great point. This is exclusively federal spending. If we include state and local, the children do fare better at that because the majority of education spending is done at the state and local level.
So what is the Democratic case for spending more on children? Why should we? I mean, you've been a lot of people that might be listening to this saying, hey, if you're a parent, you made the decision to have a child. It's your responsibility to take care of that child. It's not the federal government's responsibility. So what's the Democratic case for investing more in programs for children?
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it's we have to look at ourselves and say, what is the country we want to be building? And to me, that means I want a country that is focused on a better tomorrow for every one of its citizens. And I think that means making sure that kids aren't growing up in poverty, they have enough food in their bellies, and they're getting a great education. Because when, you know, a kid is well fed and can have a great education, they can continue to be a better and better citizen in the United States. And that doesn't matter where they were born or, you know, what they're going to do. You know, that just to me makes a big difference. And so, you know, I think focusing on spending and investing in our future is a better use of a dollar, that next marginal dollar, than thinking about, you know, something that we spent on the past. Also in this paper, I did another look at this. Instead of just comparing seniors and children, what if we compared future-oriented spending to past-oriented spending, which is, okay, you know, we'll take spending on children, and then we'll add in roads and bridges and other sort of investment. And then we'll take spending on elderly, and we'll add in net interest and other sorts of legacy costs like support for veterans and things like that. Then it evens out a little bit more. And we're much more in the kind of in the $1.50 on the past to a dollar in the future. But over the next few years, that's gonna kind of increase. So, you know, the situation here is the trend is not getting better in this ratio. We're actually at a relatively high point, thanks to, you know, investments in education and the American Rescue Plan Act. But it's reversing.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking with Zach Moeller, Director of Economic Policy at Third Way. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking with Zach Moeller, Director of Economic Policy at Third Way. And Tory, you are asking some questions about investing in children, and you still have a follow-up question.
Yeah, so one of the, I don't know if you want to call it a silver lining, but one of the opportunities that COVID presented was a massive investment in programs for children. We saw a lot of the COVID relief bills. They expanded the child tax credit. They expanded nutrition programs. They expanded, you know, connectivity. So kids who were in school and schools were closed, they could then connect to the internet and participate in education programs over Zoom. Healthcare, there was an expansion, you know, in healthcare services for children as well. And the problem, and of course, the child poverty outcomes improved under those programs. Problem now is COVID is essentially over as far as the government is concerned, and those programs are expiring. So question to you, Zach, is, you know, should those programs be continued? Should they be allowed to expire because COVID is over? Are Democrats kind of overplaying their hand in trying to maintain these programs? What's sort of the path forward when the policy justification for these improvements was COVID and COVID is gone? What do we do here?
So it's a great question, Tory. You know, I'd make just kind of two points of that. First point, I think the American Rescue Plan Act, which was the big bill that invested a lot in children at the start of the Biden administration, it was about fighting COVID and the COVID economic crisis we were finding ourselves in. So that included things that were not necessarily exclusively about public health. So things like the child tax credit were important economic programs to kind of dig us out of that deep recession we found ourselves in. Now, I think if the Biden administration could do it over again. They might structure that differently in the bill because it has expired. Child poverty has ticked back up, and we are now awaiting a bipartisan tax deal in Congress to increase the child tax credit again. There's been a good amount of work on that. I am hopeful that something will get done. There is a deal, but they're just trying to figure it out. But it is not going to be remotely the levels that we saw in, you know, kind of the Biden plan and what the president is running on this year. But, you know, we'll see. I would say that Democrats would hope that a second Biden administration could continue these promises. But, you know, obviously, it's all up to legislators, too.
Well, your third point in the Issue Briefs Act is we're lying to ourselves about the Social Security challenge. That sounds like something that Steve can ask about. Steve?
So, yeah, Zach, we're talking about the imbalance between federal spending on children versus seniors. And obviously the biggest senior program is Social Security, and next to that is Medicare. So, I mean, you know, there were years ago when, you know, President Bill Clinton was in office, and even under President Obama, there seemed to be a bit of a bipartisan consensus that, you know, we maybe needed to slow the growth of Social Security. And one popular way of doing that, would, of course, would be raising the retirement age. But that consensus seems to have broken down. I mean, you know, the Democrats and even former President Trump is now saying, you know, we're not going to touch seniors, or we're not going to touch Social Security. And we last year, the State of the Union, President Biden urged all of the Congress to stand up for seniors and promise not to touch Social Security and Medicare. I mean, what's going on? I mean, financially, those trust funds, Social Security, Medicare trust funds, are approaching insolvency. And yet everyone seems to be acting like we can continue to do nothing. What's your thought here?
Sure. So look, without rescue, Social Security, which is, you know, undoubtedly one of Democrats' greatest policy achievements, without rescue, it's going to fail to pay full benefits that the beneficiaries expect. You know, we're talking 2033, 2034. And that seems like a long time off. But regardless of who wins this presidential election this year, it's going to be the president after that deals with it, you know, because President Trump or President Biden would only have one more term. You know, look, after 2020, Social Security went from, you know, having more income than benefits being paid out. And now it's the opposite case. The trust fund itself is shrinking. And when those assets run out, we're looking at about a 23% cut across the board. If the trust fund binds at that point, if we're only paying benefits out for every dollar we're taking in. The challenge here is Democrats think broadly that there's two easy solutions. And I just disagree that they're as easy as Democratic policymakers and politicians say they are. The first is, well, there's a lot of ability to raise taxes on the rich and high-income earners. And, you know, okay, you can raise the payroll tax max, but if you eliminated it, that wouldn't get you all the way there on Social Security solvency. And again, that would be a very large tax increase. And then the other is we can kind of wave a wand and say, all right, well, the Social Security Trust Fund doesn't necessarily need to be a trust fund anymore. We can backfill any shortfall in Social Security benefits from general revenue, from the rest of the money that the government is taking in, or through more bond issuance through the deficit. And while, sure, the Congressional Budget Office, which is Congress's scorekeeper, says that is costless, that doesn't mean that it is actually costless. When market participants, the bond markets, even everyday people kind of recognize, oh, Social Security isn't as protected anymore. So that's kind of the challenge. And I think Democrats have to wrestle with that and figure out what is a good path forward on Social Security. Social Security is not going to be something that Democrats are going to only solve by themselves. It's going to take bipartisan support. Unlike, you know, recent big pieces of legislation that both parties have done, they're not going to be able to use the budget reconciliation process to deal with Social Security. It's actually prohibited under the rules. So to save Social Security, it's going to take it's going to take 60 votes in the Senate. It's going to be subject to the filibuster, and it's unlikely that a single party will have enough control to kind of deal with it on its own.
Yeah. So, You know, the last time Congress dealt with Social Security was back in, you know, in a major way, was back in 1983. And, you know, the trust funds at that point, at that time, were literally months away from, you know, being exhausted. They had borrowed money from the Medicare trust fund to put into the Social Security trust fund to keep benefits flowing. And, you know, literally it was sort of one of these last minute deals. I mean, what's your concern? I mean, you know, in theory, you know, we're talking about retirement and long-term planning. If you make changes sooner, people have time to prepare. I mean, what, you know, are you concerned that, you know, given the history here of politicians not wanting to deal with the problem until the last minute, you know, what's your concern that we're going to wait till the last minute? You know, you're talking about the next president dealing with this, but what if he waits till the end of his term, and you know, we're once again approaching the insolvency date, and Congress hasn't acted? I mean, is that a concern?
I mean, it's definitely a concern, because the sooner you deal with you deal with the finances of Social Security, the easier the adjustments would become, especially if you're doing it exclusively within the Social Security system, that is payroll taxes and scheduled benefits. But, you know, the pressure, the further and further, the closer and closer you get to that deadline, is going to be immense. So an average wage worker, somebody who's maybe retiring this year, their benefits in 2033 would get cut by about $425 a month. That's what that benefit would cut would be. Or if you did that all on the payroll tax side, a worker in 2033 would see their payroll taxes going, they'd be paying 30% more in payroll taxes. So that's like here's what you do in an emergency one way or another. And I don't think anyone's going to be happy with that. You know, no one's going to want to put the burden exclusively on those that are working, or exclusively on the retirees themselves. So, you know, you're only the longer you wait, the options kind of get worse. And that's one of the big challenges.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking with Zach Moeller, Director of Economic Policy at Third Way. We've been discussing his commentary called A Democratic Case for Fiscal Responsibility, and he will continue to make that case after this short break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking with Zach Moeller, Director of Economic Policy at Third Way. And we've been discussing an issue brief he wrote called A Democratic Case for Fiscal Responsibility. And one of the points that he made is a point that Tory has made in issue briefs for us about revenues. Tory, let me pass this one to you.
So, Zach, one of the points that you make is that our tax system, our tax structure, we're basically leaking revenue like a sieve. I've actually made the, Bob's talking about a reference I once made. You know, with everything that we've promised in terms of benefits and how hard it is for lawmakers to cut spending, in order to meet our promises across the board, we're gonna need a bigger boat. Think of the line from Jaws, you know, they're sitting there saying, the Sheriff Brody is saying, as we attack the shark, we're gonna need a bigger boat. What I hear you saying in your analysis here is not only are we gonna need a bigger boat, we're gonna need a sturdier boat, one that doesn't leak like a sieve. So my question to you is, where are these revenue leaks? What sort of form do they take, and what sort of impact are they having on the federal budget?
Sure. So, I mean, I think people need to recognize how low tax of a country the United States actually is, compared to other OECD countries, where, you know, we're really near the bottom. But that being said, you know, we do still have a pretty progressive tax structure. So, you know, a good chunk of the American people don't feel the pinch of the IRS very much. I mean, what taxes they do pay are primarily payroll taxes or excise taxes or their state and local taxes. At the federal level, if we're going to talk federal taxes, we spend a lot of time thinking about tax cuts in the United States. You know, there is so many policies that are actually being done and pursued through the tax code We'll get a tax break for this, a tax break for that. And we don't do it through spending programs. So that just means, you know, you will need more revenue in other ways because we keep opening these little holes in the tax code in a lot of different places. That being said, besides tax breaks and tax credits, we also have pretty insufficient tax enforcement in the United States. There's a big tax gap of what people ostensibly owe and what they actually pay. And a fiscally responsible tax code means tackling all of these pieces. It means tackling enforcement. It means closing tax breaks and credits, but also making sure that you can, you know, if I use a metaphor like a bucket, if we punched a whole bunch of holes in the bucket, you still need to also make sure water is coming into the bucket, which is economic growth. So you need all of those pieces together because just one of them isn't going to necessarily solve it.
One of the things I think is kind of difficult here is obviously one of the easiest ways to plug the holes is just to simplify the tax code, right? If you take away all these exceptions and one-off provisions. But Bill Gill over at Brookings recently just put out a paper where he really demonstrates how tax simplification makes it really hard to meet other competing goals of, you know, for simplicity, but also progressivity and fairness. You know, he gives the example, you know, suppose that you want to subsidize childcare costs, but you don't want to give money to people that they can then spend on ski school for their kids at Aspen, right? So you've got to write these exceptions and phase in, you know, and maybe you don't want to provide support for the uber wealthy. So you've got to write in these phase-ins and phase-outs. So how do you balance this tension between wanting to plug all these holes, but also wanting a tax code that is progressive and is fair? Do you see anybody who's leading on these efforts? Do you have any solutions or contributions to the debate about what we should be looking at?
I mean, it's a great question, but unfortunately, I don't have a great answer because everyone is looking out for their own individual interests in the tax code, whether that's companies and their specific tax breaks, whether that's a politician and his or her specific tax break or credit that they put in a bill and are trying to extend. We deal with tax policy all the time in Congress because we set it to expire for a variety of reasons. And then it just creates all these moments for horse trading or log rolling where, okay, I'm going to trade your credit for my credit. And we've actually made the situation worse, not better. That's what we're looking at right now for 2025. The Trump tax cuts will expire, or at least the individual income tax side of the Trump tax cuts are going to expire in 2025, which means that, you know, unless we act on that, taxes will go up for people. And that's no fault of Congress's. That would just be what happens if they don't do anything. But how that horse trading takes place after this election is going to be really interesting. And, you know, that's the big focus of 2025. And that's it's part of why I actually wrote this piece, is because we all have to get on the same page. What is everyone's ask at the end of the day when the Trump tax bill expires? And I'm trying to get Democrats to say, my ask is we don't make the debt situation worse.
So that was going to be my question, is whether 2025, is that an opportunity for Congress to be more fiscally responsible? Do you think that's where the ball will end up, or, you know, deficits be damned and we're just going to extend the tax cuts without any thought about the cost?
I mean, that is the next moment for 2025 is the next moment for Congress to actually face up to the fiscal challenges. We've gotten ourselves kind of on an autopilot through the rest of 2024 because there was a deal made on discretionary spending, that annually appropriated amount of money that's supposed to clear us through next year and through the election. And then all these moments are going to happen in 2025. The debt limit is going to come back and we're going to deal with that. The Affordable Care Act tax credits, part of those tax credits are going to expire and we're going to have to deal with that. We'll deal with discretionary spending again and the ending of statutory caps on those levels. And then a few other things like the Trump tax cuts. So 2025, that's going to be a heck of a year.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to that. Fiscal Armageddon. That leads me to your last point, which is one that the Concord Coalition has been making for quite some time, which is if you don't do these other things that you are talking about, revenue, Social Security, you know, investing in children. What happens is you come to the default, which is cut discretionary spending and specifically cut non-defense discretionary spending. So you talk about, you know, that's if that's where a lot of Democratic priorities are housed in the budget. And the dynamic is they're always first up on the cutting room floor. And I just, you kind of make this point, but we made it in a, you know, things that we've done over the past years. And I keep track of this number, but, you know, about 40 years ago, if you go back, we spent almost 20% of the budget on investments. And now it's under 10%. We spent about 4% of GDP on investments. Now it's about 2%. So, you know, the numbers fluctuate a little bit every year, and COVID made the numbers a little bit screwy. But basically, you know, we've cut in half what we spend on investments through the budget.
Yeah, I mean, look, non-defense discretionary is, you know, it was about $900 billion last year. In total discretionary, which is defense and non-defense, was about 28% of spending. Look, non-defense discretionary is always targeted by Republicans. It is consistently attacked, whether it was in President Trump's budget, whether it was in Speaker Ryan's budget, back when he was budget chair. Like, it comes up a lot. But then Republicans actually find moments of leverage and squeeze it, right? In the debt limit debate of last year, in the debt limit debate back right when I came to Washington in 2010 and 2011, you know, those were moments where non-defense discretionary got squeezed a lot. And it covers items that Democrats had traditionally championed for decades: medical research, transportation, space exploration, technology, federal education spending, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So it is something that, you know, if you want to kind of disarm that kind of partisan tension, the Republicans attacking Democrats over federal spending issues and this, like, deal with other spending so that it doesn't affect, you know, your Democratic priorities as much. That's part of the point I try to make in the piece.
Well, I just got to say, we got about a minute left. What do we do about all this?
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, there's going to be lots of moments to have all these conversations. We're going to need tax reform to increase revenue from those who can most afford it and reduce distortions in our economy so that we can maintain a pro-growth footing. I think a commission would be a great idea to look at improving the finances of Social Security, because Social Security is going to have to be done on a bipartisan basis. So why not start with a bipartisan Social Security commission? Our healthcare system needs to lower costs for patients and for taxpayers. So we're going to need more health reforms to save the federal government money in healthcare. And look, there's going to be moments for thoughtful government efficiency and modernization. If we want government to work for everyone, and I think every politician wants the government to work better, they may have slightly different definitions of better, but if everyone wants it to do better, if everyone wants government to do better, we need a more modern and efficient administrative capacity in the federal government.
Well, Zach, I want to thank you for joining us today and making the Democratic case for fiscal responsibility. I'll take any case for fiscal responsibility. We certainly need it. Tori and Steve and I are going to be back after this short break to look at the latest inflation numbers and the Fed's March meeting. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tori Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about inflation in this segment and how that might affect the Federal Reserve Board's upcoming decisions on interest rates. I mean, this is really an important topic, a very well-watched topic. If you go back a few months, many people were projecting that the Fed would begin to lower rates in March, in their March meeting. Doesn't look like that's happening. Just, so, Steve, we've got some you know, part of the dilemma is that the economy still seems to be doing fairly well, and inflation still seems to be stuck at somewhere around 3%, and jobs are still growing. And so, you know, what's the Federal Reserve to do? Do they want to try to ratchet interest rates up to try to get the inflation back down, or just wait and see how things play out? What's your advice to the Federal Reserve Board?
I'm not sure they want my advice, but
well, they probably don't, but that's okay.
yeah, what's another country heard from? You know, I mean, this is, I guess, is a little bit like Groundhog Day. I mean, every month now for the past 6 months, we keep, you know, sort of waking up and saying, okay, well, is it going to be a longer winter or a earlier spring? And, you know, it's the same dynamic here. I mean, you know, inflation peaked back in 2022 at about 9%, and, or, you know, that summer, and it's come down to about 3% this past summer, but it's kind of stuck there. I mean, we've seen the numbers bounce around between 3 and 4% roughly for the past 6-8 months. Inflation ticked up just slightly this past month from January to February. And so, yeah, I mean, the Fed has a real dilemma. I mean, you know, their policy tool of adjusting the federal funds rate, the interest rate that they try to control, which is the rate at which banks borrow from each other in the overnight market. You know, they try to adjust that rate by buying and selling government securities and mortgage-backed securities. And, you know, everyone was sort of assuming that as inflation came down, the Fed would begin lowering the interest rate. But inflation is sort of stuck. And so as a result, the Fed is also stuck. You know, whether they, and I think it's a foregone conclusion, we're recording this before they meet tomorrow, but, you know, it's a foregone conclusion that the Fed is going to stand pat, that they're going to leave interest rates where they are at the moment and wait for more data. I mean, their decision really is being highly driven by the data from month to month. You know, they're watching the unemployment rate, which is also sort of bouncing around and ticked up slightly this past month. So, you know, while the economy is certainly still growing, and, you know, unemployment is below 4%, you know, they have to weigh that trade-off. Do they assume that inflation will come down on its own and they're going to avoid unemployment rising by reducing interest rates and trying to ease that transition? I think there's a consensus that they're going to cut the rate still at some point this year. But again, that's highly contingent on what inflation does and what the economy does. And we seem to be on a glide path, although, like most things in the economy, things rarely glide smoothly from point A to point B. There's always bumps up and down along the way. And I think we're going to continue to see that. And we're just going to have to wait for the Fed to get more data. And I think it'll become clearer as we move through the year. But I don't think anybody should get their hopes up that we're going to see too much movement in any direction too soon.
It's beginning to look like that soft landing that everybody's wants to achieve, that we're kind of circling the airport at this point before we know quite if what the path is to actually land the plane.
Yeah.
Tori, are there any trends that stick out for you?
Yeah, actually, it's a good question. Yeah, one of the things I think, especially Wall Street, they get too focused on a single data point in time, and they don't, you know, to use your airplane method, they don't go up to 30,000 feet and take a look at what's going on. And so before we hopped on the air today, I looked at sort of the month-to-month trend in inflation over the last 5-6 months. And what concerns me is that it's going in the wrong direction. You know, if you look in October of 23, the month-to-month change was only about 0.1%. November, it was 0.2%. December, 0.2%. But then January, 0.3%. February, 0.4%. Okay, so the month over month, I mean, there are two ways to look at inflation, right? You can look at where prices were, they were versus a year ago versus last month. And the month-to-month number sort of gives you a good idea of where we're heading. The year-over-year number tells you where we've been. And so what I'm getting nervous is that the month-to-month numbers are accelerating. Prices are accelerating on a month-to-month basis. And that, in my mind, is not a good trend as far as prices. But then, you know, we also got some jobs data recently and for February. And one of the interesting things there, that the February number itself wasn't all that newsworthy. What was newsworthy to me were the revisions to jobs in December and January. You remember those were a big gangbuster months where everybody's like, whoa, job market is still really, really healthy. Well, there was a big write down in December and January job numbers in the February job report. You know, December was marked down 43,000. January, which was that big, huge month of, you know, 353,000 jobs created. Well, they whacked 124 off of that number. And so between the 2 months combined, you know, we actually created 167,000 less jobs, fewer jobs than originally estimated. And when the revisions start going in a downward direction, you know, that makes me wonder if we are somewhere near some sort of a turning point. Again, you need more data. You need to look at the trend. One data point, two data points do not make a trend. Three data points, four data points, that's a trend. So those are sort of the things that I'm looking at. Is inflation hotter and accelerating than people think? And is the job market softening?
Yeah, and they do have, this question of what to do with interest rates has, you know, it certainly has political overtones. And you know, not that the Fed is driven by that. It's just that if you think about the timing, if you get an interest rate cut in the spring or early summer, it could become caught up in presidential politics. This is always a dilemma for the Fed.
Well,
I think that's one of the reasons why Powell is so data driven.
Yeah, I mean, the issue here is if inflation continues to come down, you can make a case that, OK, we've got inflation contained and we can afford a rate cut. You know, the dilemma is the worst is that if inflation continues to tick up, does the Fed dare to raise interest rates, you know, in the few months before an election? And how is that going to be viewed from the public's perspective and from the campaign perspective? I mean, that actually is perhaps an even bigger risk.
We've talked about this this before, but anything in the latest numbers to indicate that inflation on the really sensitive areas like food, gas, housing, the things that people feel in their day-to-day lives, and that they don't, you know, they feel that we still have high inflation because of those things. Is there anything in the recent data that may show some relief there?
Yeah, that's interesting. When you take a look at the most recent CPI report, I kind of feel bad for President Biden. He can't catch a break. Just at a time when food prices are flat. Okay, so there's been, you know, the CPI for last month said there's basically been no increase in food prices. Energy prices went up largely. It's gasoline at the pump went up, you know, 2.3%. And of course, shelter housing. We've been talking about the housing dilemma, and Steve can probably elaborate more on that. But we've been talking about how housing has been contributing, you know, the housing shortage, you know, et cetera, has been contributing to high rents, high shelter costs. And yeah, just between energy prices and shelter costs alone, that was 60% of the increase in the CPI last month. So, you know, yay, food prices stopped rising for 1 month. But, you know, you're paying more at the pump.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a dilemma. I mean, when we say inflation is slowing, that just means the rate of increase is lower or less. It doesn't mean that prices have gone back down. I mean, I think I had commented a week or two ago where, you know, overall prices are much higher than they were before COVID or even, you know, in the last year or so. And, you know, to say, well, don't worry because prices are rising less slowly, that doesn't give people a lot of comfort because prices are not going down and things aren't cheaper. It's just they're increasing at a lower rate.
Yeah, and that's we'd all like to turn the clock back on some of those things. And anyway, it's going to it will have an effect on the budget. I mean, that's why we talk about it, the budget and the economy. But that's all the time we have for this week. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I have been discussing the latest inflation numbers, the jobs numbers and what it may mean for the Federal Reserve Board as they try to decide what to do with interest rates in the coming weeks and months. Tune in again next week when we'll be back with another edition of Facing the Future.